We welcome you to a not your usual edition of El Paso Primetime, a production of KTEP. Here we are in the middle of June, and we're getting close to the release of a wonderful book, counting down Bruce Springsteen, his 100 finest songs. And with me is the author of that, the second in a series of counting down books, really and truly. Jim Baviglia is on the line. Jim, welcome to El Paso Primetime.
Oh, Dennis, thanks so much for having me.
Well, first off, let me ask you how you got started in doing stuff like this. And you started with the Bob Dylan book, counting down Bob Dylan, his 100 finest songs.
Right. It was all kind of came out of a blog that I started a few years back. I had done other lists for some of the online sites that I wrote for. And I just started a blog because, you get to a point where, they're telling you how many words it has to be. And, well, we could only put it in this day and that day. And I just wanted to write about music and not have any sort of limitations on it. And so that's how I started. I said, I'm going to count down the top 200 Bob Dylan songs and give my reasons for it. And it got a nice response, and eventually I got a publisher's attention, and that's where that began. So that was last year that came out, and now the Springsteen book just about ready to come out.
Well, it's a funny thing about you write it in the introduction, and it seems like you wrote about me.
Okay. Good.
I don't get Dylan. Or at least I didn't until I started reading your book, and all of a sudden everything started falling into place. I never liked his voice, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
But
I found with Dylan that it's either an all or nothing kind of thing. People are kind of either all in or they're just not having it. But I'm glad to hear that, and so other people have told me this that have read the book, that they said, well, it wasn't really, he's not really my thing, but after reading some of your essays and listening to it, then I kind of sort of get it. So that's always nice to hear that maybe I could convert some people, as well as just sort of preaching to the choir.
Back in the day, as I was growing up through high school and through grade school and junior high and all that, there were the ones who got it, and then there were me.
Yeah, he's definitely, for some people it is, it's an acquired taste, and some people never do acquire it. But, I mean, I've just been a huge fan really since the college is when I really started to pick it up. Up until then, I'd only known bits and pieces. My time of sort of really becoming indoctrinated to music was the 80s, which wasn't the best period for Dylan. And then as I got into college, I started listening, I started looking back, and really got hooked from there on out. And just find his work to be really endlessly fascinating. And even after writing a book about it, I don't even pretend to think that I know everything there is about those songs, and that's part of the fun of them. You could just keep digging deep into them.
Jim, what got you started in writing about music in the first place?
I started probably about a decade ago, just freelance writing. It was something I've always written a little bit on the side. I did it for my full-time job. I'm in public relations, and so I always did a little bit of writing. And it was just something that I wanted to try out. And I just went to the computer, sort of Googled freelance writing and how to get started in it. And little by little started, looking for different online jobs, and was lucky enough to find a few that were music-related. It was something that I always wanted to write about because I've been such a music nut all my life. And little by little, it's built up from there, and now it's really coming into fruition now with the books and writing for American Songwriter. It's really something that I never could have imagined when I started that I'd have published books out there. It just blows my mind.
When we get into the nuts and bolts of this, there has always been the argument that's been sitting on the table about Bob Dylan versus Bruce Springsteen anyway, who has more of the hidden prolific nature of lyrics, being able to reach out into Americana and then bring it right back out of the heartland and into urban America. which one is the better of the two?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. I don't know that I'd say that there's one that's better. I think the approaches are so different. The analogy, I think I use it somewhere in the Dylan book, is that, you know, whereas Springsteen, you know, goes from A to Z and hits all the letters B, C, D, and E, Dylan will go from A to Z, but he'll go to G and then go to D and then go to X, and he'll sort of bounce all over the map. Dylan is definitely tougher to sort of corral. There aren't too many Bruce Springsteen songs that I can think of that I don't really feel like I have a good handle on what they're about generally. But there are a lot of Dylan songs where I could give it a good guess, but you know, I think that they're a little bit more harder to corral. And some people like that, and some people don't want to really battle for it. They just want to have it, you know, a little bit easier for them to understand. And I think that's where, you know, Springsteen has able really to get to a sort of a bigger audience, maybe, because it is stuff that people can relate to easily and not have to really work at it, not have to scratch their heads. And I just think they're different disciplines. I don't know that one's better than the other. And I think, you know, Springsteen can do things that Dylan can't and vice versa. So I don't know that I would say one is better. I love them both. They're both two of my, you know, all-time favorite songwriters. And both have enough songs that I can write these books and still have a lot of songs left over that I could talk about forever.
You know, and it's curious about these two gentlemen in particular in terms of how they reach out through the baby boomer generation, the 70s generation, Generation X, and now Generation Me. You know, all of the songs that we've been talking about so far, Dylan and Springsteen, seems to run five generations deep, and everyone seems to have some kind of a handle and some kind of an appreciation for them.
And that's what makes them such great artists, Dennis, is that, you know, their works do resonate. And I think there's a difference in there again, in that Dylan has gone through really sort of drastic shifts in his career, where the music has drastically changed from album to album or from time period to time period. And so sometimes it takes a while for people to get a handle on that. And just when they think they have the handle on it, he switches it up again. Whereas Springsteen, it's more of a gradual thing where I think people can kind of trace their own lives through Springsteen's work. If you sort of follow his albums, there's a through line there where these characters, you know, they're young and they're partying, and then they have to get jobs, and then they go into their first romances, and sometimes they don't work out, and they go into their second romance, and then they're dealing with middle-aged. And it's really a neat thing about Springsteen's body of work that you can really follow it through as somebody's life, obviously Springsteen's life, but then I think the people in the audience are seeing, hey, I went through all this stuff as well.
Yeah. When we get back into the Bob Dylan Counting Down book, one of the things that strikes at me are the two albums that actually do resonate with me, Blood on the Tracks and Blonde on Blonde.
Those are just, you know, those are sort of the tent poles of Dylan's career, the two that really, and he's had a lot of great albums, and those are the two that, you know, people always ask me, well, which is your favorite album, and I can't decide between those two. Blonde on Blonde is really when he was at the peak of his powers, when he was just so hyper-dynamic and just spitting out lyrics, and it was all just sort of coming through him from another place. He was just off firing on all cylinders, and just this amazing double album full of material. And after that, he sort of backed away from all that and then sort of moved into more of a folk-based idiom and country. And then Blonde on Blonde, of course, everybody says, well, that's his divorce album. Well, technically, it's not quite, because he didn't get divorced till after, but certainly you could see sort of the fissures of the relationship that he was going through with his wife, and that was all out there in the music and so raw and so emotional. And a lot of people who have gone through hard times in relationships, they grab onto that album as sort of a lifeline because he sort of went through that, and you could sort of, you know, live vicariously through that, all that pain. Dylan, the great quote about Dylan with Blonde on Blonde is somebody, you know, once asked him about the album, and he says, you know, he said, well, I can't understand how people can listen to all that pain, he said. but I mean, the thing is, of course, we live vicariously through that, and it's catharsis and all that. But I think even he realized how raw it all was.
Do you find yourself trying to put these two in a different category than others? Like, say, for instance, John Cougar Mellencamp. Sometimes Beck will come in and out of that kind of a conversation, that sort of a thing. Do you find these two standing away from that style of songwriting? Or is Mellencamp a minor league version of these two?
Yeah, I think the thing that separates them, I have great respect for Mellencamp's work as well. I think that there's just not quite the body of work that there is there with Springsteen and with Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for any, you know, like a newer artist like that, obviously Beck's been around a while now, but for a newer artist like him, again, that's always the thing, is that how do you match up to all these great albums? You might have one or two, but then how do you keep releasing them year after year? And maybe down the road, you know, Beck is one of those artists, if he's still doing it into his 50s and 60s. Dylan's in his early 70s now, and he released an album 2 years ago, Tempest, that in my opinion can stand up with his very best work. So that's the thing for any artist. That's the real sort of threshold, that, okay, you might be able to, you know, knock out some big hits, and you might be able to have, you know, several good albums, but can you keep doing it year after year, and can you keep releasing at such a high level like these guys have done? And I think there are a few others in that class, like a guy like Elvis Costello or a guy like Tom Petty. Certainly there are others in that group. I think, obviously, you know, you look at the work of Lennon McCartney, it wasn't as long lasting as theirs was because of the breakup, but again, their body of work stands up because they just had so many amazing songs in such a short amount of time. I think there are other songwriters in that sort of Mount Rushmore, if you will, mm-hmm. but it's very tough to get there.
The Mount Rushmore of the Great American Songbook has to now extend themselves into Dylan and Springsteen, don't you agree?
Yeah, I think so. I think it would be tough to, you know, to construct it without them. And I think, you know, one of the things I hope that I do with the Springsteen book that I hope people get out of it is Springsteen has developed such a well-earned live reputation now, where he's such an amazing live performer, and people just rave about it. And, you know, there's people who go to 20 shows and 30 shows, and they compare this version to that version. And that's all fine and good. I agree, he is just an amazing live performer. But I hope that people don't lose sight of what an amazing recording artist he is, because those live performances don't exist without the amazing body of work that he put on record, and without those amazing albums, without Born to Run, without Darkness on the Edge of Town, without Born in the USA, without Nebraska. I mean, if you don't have those as a starting point, and so for when I see newer fans coming into Springsteen, that's what I hope to get to them. You know, he's not like, you know, just a touring artist where he just puts out a record just so he has an excuse to go out there. He's very meticulous with his craft and his songwriting and his recording, and I hope people go back to these original albums now and really dissect them like I have, and I think you'll find Springsteen, like you said, on that Mount Rushmore of rock and roll.
You know, I look at the discography of Springsteen, and my collection stops. It's Lucky Town. And it is, as I recall, Human Touch and Lucky Town were released simultaneously.
That's
it
right.
Was kind of a funky sort of a thing that Columbia was trying to test out to see which one would outdo the other.
Yeah, it's interesting. Those albums, and you know, honestly, I think those albums may have lost a few people, because at the time Springsteen was he had sort of disbanded the E Street Band. He was doing it with other musicians, and I think it sort of slowed his momentum for a while. And if there are people who kind of jumped off, I hope that they got back on, because he's sort of rounded back into form. He's had several albums of late, Magic and Working on a Dream and Wrecking Ball, that are all of a very high caliber, and you really can stand with his best work. But there definitely was a fallow period for Springsteen, and I think all artists go through that. And but the fact that he's been able to rebound now and he's on sturdier footing than ever, that's a testament to his resiliency, which is one of the things he talks about in his songs so much. So he certainly lived up to that.
Well, I remember the live collection, the live 75 to 85 collection, because that's in my collection. And I really like that, but I was surprised to find out about the MTV, Live in New York City, the London, and the Dublin concert albums.
Yeah, there's he is slowly amassed quite an impressive batch of live recordings, and the unplugged, or as he put it, plugged, because he actually didn't stay unplugged. He played the first song acoustically, and then he came out with the band and played electric songs, because he's Bruce Springsteen, who was going to tell him not to.
Right.
That's an interesting a lot of people get down on that era, but that's a great live album. The problem in that era wasn't the band. He had an excellent band. They were different than the E Street Band, but they were a solid group of studio pros, and the band was great, and you hear that on that live performance. I just think the songwriting, Springsteen was kind of in a funky period of his life, and the songwriting wasn't quite at the level that he usually is at.
You and me, we were the pretend. We let it all slip away. In the end, what you don't win, well, the world just strips away. Girl, ain't no kindness in the face of strangers. Ain't gonna find no miracles here. Well, you can wait on your blessings, my God. I got a deal for you right here. I ain't looking for prayers of pity. I ain't coming around searching for a crutch. I just want someone to talk to in a little of that human touch. Just a little of that human touch.
Our guest this afternoon on El Paso Primetime is Jim Beviglia, and he's written a couple of books. The first one is a real tasty treat called Counting Down Bob Dylan, His 100 Finest Songs. New one that's about to be released this month, and you can pre-order on Amazon.com, is Counting Down Bruce Springsteen, His 100 Finest Songs. So I have to ask you this question. Let's go right back to the Nebraska sessions. The article that you wrote for American Songwriter really struck me as the sort of behind-the-scenes sort of thing. I love stories about songs and how they come to fruition. And Born in the USA, something that John Landau just didn't like.
Yeah, first of all, you and me both, Dennis. I love stories about how these songs sort of came about. And Born in the USA, I don't know that a lot of people know, is that Born in the USA was performed by Springsteen on the same demo tape that begat the Nebraska album. And, of course, the Nebraska album was a bunch of songs that he intended to record at the E Street Band, but when he got them in the studio, they tried, and they just couldn't capture the feel, and then he realized sort of the haunting nature of those demos. That's the way that the record should come out, and he did. He didn't include Born in the USA because in that sort of acoustic demo, you don't really hear its full potential. And that's what John Landau knew of the song. He is his producer, Springsteen's producer, John Landau, and he said, this didn't think much of it. And then when they sort of reconvened the band to do an electric session, which would be Born in the USA, one of the first things Springsteen brought out was Born in the USA, and they were like, well, this isn't, why are we doing this again? This song, this is a dead song, was Landau's quote. And sure enough, Springsteen had other ideas for it. He knew this sort of new arrangement with the synthesizer and the huge drums and just shouting out those lyrics and really transformed the song into the anthem that it is today.
That, of course, is Bruce Springsteen and Born in the USA, a number one hit for the man in the United States and I think also around the world. And it truly is an anthem. It's very hard to create something like that. An anthem really has to strike out universally, and this one really has done that over the years. It stands the test of time.
And it's a kind, I mentioned the article and I mentioned the book. It's a kind of a complex thing because, a lot of people hear that chorus, that Born in the USA chorus. I mean, people play it at fireworks displays to this day, and people sort of have their hand on their heart listening to it. But if you listen to those lyrics, they're very sort of accusatory about the way that America treated Vietnam veterans upon their return home. Mm-hmm. And I think Springsteen was kind of saying, it's all part of it. This is what America America is about. You know, we're all part of this, and we're part of the good things about it, and we're part of the bad things about it. And so it's a very complex anthem, and I think, you know, I think you're, it's okay if you want to celebrate it as sort of patriotic, and it's okay if you want to look at it as kind of accusatory. It's that malleable song that it can work in both ways.
And I think it's why it works both ways is why President Barack Obama uses it occasionally when he's away from the White House and he does tours inside America. I know that when he came to El Paso about 2.5 years ago, after his speech and after he left the Chamizal National Memorial, they cranked up Born in the USA. And I thought then, I thought how unusual that that would be played. But as I got on into the nuts and bolts of it a couple of years later by reading your article, now I get it.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. I think that, you know, there is, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, who may be, you know, sort of on the opposite side of Springsteen politically might want to say, oh, you know, how's he, you know, he's criticizing the U.S. And, you know, it is critical. But again, I think there is room for the patriotism in that song. Again, it's sort of all encompassing. The good and the bad are in there. And that's what makes it. It's a really fantastic songwriting achievement done in very short strokes, not a lot of words in the song, and just very efficient at getting its point across. And then you add the way it was recorded, that recording is just so monumental. And Springsteen's not naive. He knew the people were going to hear the chorus and the sort of rousing sound, and he knew people were going to salute it. And I don't think he's trying to subvert anybody with the song. I think it's, you know, I think he means it to be sort of this all-encompassing thing.
When you get down to the nuts and bolts of the Springsteen book without releasing any surprises and such, how many tunes off of the first two albums, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey, and Wild Innocent and the E Street Shuffle, make the top 100?
Oh, they're well represented. I think the thing about those two albums is that I think they are not as consistent as other Springsteen albums. But the high points of those albums are extremely high. You know, it was Springsteen sort of writing differently than he would going on down the line. This was, you know, going back to the Dylan comparison, this was a time when people called him the new Dylan, and he was very wordy at that time. He used a lot of lyrics. He used a lot of fantastic imagery and crazy metaphors and similes and things like that. And when that all comes together on those first two albums, the results are just exhilarating. Now, the problem with those first two albums is he was still kind of finding his footing as an artist, and so a lot of times he wasn't quite sure of how to represent himself musically. The production on those first two albums are a little bit erratic, so those first two albums are inconsistent, but the high points are fantastic. And, you know, for those people who sort of came on board after Born to Run, or maybe, you know, are looking back and they see Born to Run and they start from there, I urge them to go look back at those first two albums, because there are several songs on there. Several made the top 10 of my list. Actually, four of my top 10 come from those two albums. So, again, they're a little inconsistent, but the high points, wow.
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite set of lyrics comes out of Born to Run. You're painting the portrait of Wendy as, in my mind, is this wild, long-haired, long-legged blonde who's sitting on the back of a Harley when he says, strap your limbs around these velvet rims.
Yeah.
Hey, man.
A little bit of innuendo there. I think he wasn't trying to hide that. And then there's, you know, there's another part of the song where, you know, he talks about the, you know, the boys trying to look so hard. And again, that's, you know, a little bit of a double entendre there as well.
Girls comb their hair in rearview mirrors, and the boys try to look so hard. The amusement park ride and roll and start. Kids are huddled on the beach in the mirrors. I wanna die with you, Wendy, on the street tonight.
But Born to Run is just, you know, I hope people don't take Born to Run for granted, because it is so sort of associated with Springsteen. You know, it's Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run. And sometimes when you have a signature song like that, people, after hearing it so much, they maybe tune it out a little bit. And I hope people don't do that with Born to Run, because, you know, I still, to this day, every time I hear that song, I get the same chills. And when it goes up into that big crescendo leading into the last verse, and he comes out of there just screaming that last verse, I mean, it still, you know, does it for me every time. So Born to Run, you know, you'll never catch me saying a bad word about Born to Run. I think some people get, you know, like maybe tired of it. He plays it every show, but I don't see how you can. I mean, that song is just, he was, you know, he's been on record as saying he was trying to write the greatest rock and roll song ever. And you know what? You can make an argument that he succeeded.
Oh, no kidding. Now, my question would be, does he still miss Clarence Clemons?
Oh, I think he always will, and I think he would tell anybody that there's you know there's a hole there that no one could ever fill, and you know he's got you know Clarence's nephew playing on tour, does a great job, but I mean Clarence was just a one of a kind. I mean it's no stretch, and I don't think it's really you can make much of an argument elsewhere that Clarence is the you know the greatest saxophone player in rock and roll history. I mean, Springsteen, you know, when Springsteen brought him aboard, they just, you know, the saxophone just wasn't used in rock and roll at that point anymore. You know, it was used kind of in the late 50s and the early 60s, and then sort of fell out of favor when it went to psychedelia, and Springsteen brought it back, but he couldn't have done that without Clarence Clemons, and so many of his iconic songs, they would be less iconic for sure and wouldn't have the same impact if it wasn't for Clarence Clemons' input.
Would your favorite also be the number one on this chart?
Yeah, boy, I mean, I'm not, there's no spoiler alert here. Born to Run is my number one, I start out my essay about it by saying sometimes the obvious choice is obvious for a reason. And so, I think that's what Born to Run is. I mean, you know, it's just, Again, for the people who maybe have become jaded toward it for whatever reason, you know, just sort of listen to it again and really focus on it and see if it doesn't, you know, raise your hairs and, you know, give you tingles in your spine and all that fun stuff. And I think there's, you know, there's an argument to be made for other ones, but I think as far as, you know, what it achieves, what Springsteen was trying to achieve with the song, the efficiency which he delivers the message. I mean, I could go through all these sort of clinical ways to tell it, and then I could just, you know, say that it just grabs you. I think I could defend Born to Run as his number one overall song.
We've been talking to Jim Baviglia. He's written a new book, Counting Down Bruce Springsteen, His 100 Finest Songs. You can pre-order it on Amazon.com. And eventually, when this really comes out and explodes, you can buy it at Barnes & Noble?
Yeah, we're hoping we can get into the bookstores. For now, they'll probably be online, but we're hoping that this one, we're getting a great traction with this one, and we're hoping this one becomes a paperback, and it is available in bookstores. But for now, it'll be on every, you know, all your online booksellers, you know, Barnes & Noble or Amazon or wherever, you know, you buy your online books. It's available at all those. And just you can pre-order it now, and it'll be coming out very shortly. And you have it in your mailbox, and I hope everybody enjoys it.
Wonderful. Jim, thank you so much for spending some time with us, man. We really loved it.
Dennis, thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Jim Baviglia, the author of the new book, Counting Down Bruce Springsteen, His Hot 100 Finest Songs. That'll be coming out on June 16th. Next week, El Paso Primetime goes live. Save up your questions for the tummy doctor, Dr. Richard McCollum. Thanks for listening to this edition of El Paso Primetime.